Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Sunday, February 22nd, and we have today's reading of the Boston Globe being read to you by John and Cosette. Good morning.
Good morning, Billy, and good morning to everyone. Early to the fight over cost of living by Hall Heintz from Globe staff. Dateline Montpelier, Vermont. As politicians from around the country gathered in Washington, D.C. over the past week for a meeting of the National Governors Association, a single term was never far from their lips: affordability. It's become an inescapable political buzzword since last fall, when Democrats in Virginia, New Jersey, and New York City won elections promising to tackle what they called a crisis of affordability. The party has vowed to make it a centerpiece of the midterms, and governors from Massachusetts to Maine and Delaware to India have rolled out so-called affordability agendas in recent weeks. All these promises have prompted one lesser-known politician who's been campaigning on affordability for more than a dozen years to ask a simple question: where have you been? Affordability has become one of the most talked about issues in national politics today, and it's refreshing to hear previous skeptics acknowledge it matters, Vermont Governor Phil Scott said in an address to the state legislature in January. Because the affordability crisis that some of us have been talking about for decades is real. The moderate Republican first deployed the term in 2013 while serving a lieutenant governor, and it's been central to his political identity ever since. A decade into his governorship, Scott is now the second longest-serving chief executive of a state and the most popular in the country, with a 74% approval rating, according to Morning Consult. That's in no small part due to his relentless messaging around affordability, even as Vermont has grown ever more expensive. Scott attributes his early focus on the subject to his blue-collar roots. While serving his lieutenant governor, a part-time job in Vermont, he continued to run an excavation company and compete as a stock car driver at Thunder Road Speed Bowl in his gritty hometown of Barre. My social network is broad, whether it's at the racetrack or in the construction field, Scott said. He'd hear friends and family members say, I just can't afford it anymore. I just can't stay here anymore because I've talked to my cousin in Tennessee or Florida, and things aren't as bad there as they are here. Recent polling suggests that many Americans believe middle-class life is out of reach. A majority of registered voters surveyed by the New York Times last month said they could not afford the life they desire, such as the home, family, or car they want. Respondents cited education, housing, and health care as being particularly expensive. Such sentiments have posed a problem for President Trump, who has struggled to calibrate a message on it. He called it a hoax and a Democrat scam, and has focused his rhetoric on the high-flying stock market, not bread-and-butter concerns. While inflation has cooled considerably on Trump's watch, prices remain high, and 57% of Americans disapprove of his handling of cost-of-living issues, according to a recent Reuters Ipsos poll. At the state level, some governors have felt similar pressure to deliver. As she seeks re-election this year, Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey, a Democrat, has had to contend with the high cost of housing and skyrocketing energy prices. She sought to tackle it head-on in a January address to the legislature, expanding on her affordability agenda and trying to convey that she understands voters' anxieties. The reality is that these are tough times, she said. People are feeling it. Everything is more expensive. How much a single governor can do to address affordability is another question. Whether life is affordable at a given moment might have to do with the national economy or the global economy, said Christopher Shields, a historian at Rutgers Eagleton Center on the American Governor. There are all kinds of things that are outside of your control. Andre Perry, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, said governors can pull plenty of levers to address expenses such as housing, utilities, and child care. Others, though particularly health care, are more difficult to address at the state level, he said, and all leaders have a role to play. Affordability is not a one-stop shop kind of issue, Perry said. No one mayor, no one governor, no one president is the primary cause of affordability. And Scott himself readily concedes the picture has not improved during his time in office. When I talk with Vermonters today, they certainly don't think Vermont is more affordable than it was 10 years ago, he said. Nor do they think it was affordable then. Median rents have climbed in the state by 35% over just the past 5 years, while median home prices are up 55%, according to the U.S. Census Bureau and Department of Housing and Urban Development. At the same time, household income has grown by just 15%. Vermonters now pay some of the highest health insurance premiums in the country. The governor has been the governor for 10 years, and we have not seen a huge change in affordability in this state, Representative Robin Chu, a Democrat who chairs the House Appropriations Committee, said last month after Scott's address to the legislature. According to Stephanie Yu, president of the Public Assets Institute, a left-leaning think tank in Montpelier, affordability is best understood as a function of costs versus wages. The challenge in Vermont, she said, is that household costs tend to be average, but wages tend to be below average. In her view, Scott has focused far too much attention on a third factor, taxes. State taxes are not a huge part of anyone's budget, she said. When you think about whether or not you can live in Vermont, it's more about the cost of housing and health care, and below average wages. Scott disagrees. Throughout his governorship, he's vowed to oppose any increase in taxes or fees. In January, he said he would not sign the state budget if legislatures deviated from his attempts to curtail property tax increases by overhauling the education system. I get it's not all about taxes, but they have an effect on everything, he said. Scott's affordability ambitions have been stymied, he said, by the state's stagnant growth and aging population, much like other northern New England states. As Vermont's working age population shrinks, fewer people are left paying for costlier services, leading others to flee. Our demographics are really the root cause of our problem, Scott said. He also points to politics. Unlike Massachusetts, where state government is dominated by a single party, Vermont is split. For Scott's entire tenure as governor, the legislature has been controlled by Democrats, at times holding a supermajority. He blames his political opponents for ignoring his efforts to make Vermont more affordable, and he seems proud to have vetoed a record 57 bills, more than a quarter of all vetoes issued in the state's history, arguing that he's prevented Democrats from piling on the costs for taxpayers. I think if I hadn't been here, it would be much worse than it is today, he said. Not surprisingly, Democrats in Vermont see it the other way around, criticizing his vetoes of bills that would have raised the minimum wage and established a paid family leave program. Senate Majority Leader Kesha Ram Hinsdale pointed to a 2023 child care law, which the legislature enacted over Scott's objections. It provided an additional $120 million a year in subsidies to families and providers, reducing costs and increasing the number of children served. But Scott opposed a payroll tax of 0.44% to fund it. That's a bill the governor vetoed, and it's probably the best thing we've done for middle-class affordability in the last decade, Ram Hinsdale said. Shields, the Rutgers historian, says he thinks it's wise for governors to pick up the mantle of affordability, define it on their own terms, and show voters they're doing what they can to address it. But that's not without risk. Voters have made clear that they're not patient, he said. If your governor and you make a lot of promises about affordability, you're going to have to be able to point to areas where you've made a difference.
Tariff ruling returns uncertainty to Europe. This is by Gianna Smialek of the New York Times, Dateline Brussels. European officials have been hoping that 2026 would bring a measure of calm after a year of transatlantic chaos. But even as many in Europe welcomed a U.S. Supreme Court decision overturning President Trump's across-the-board tariffs, the ruling kicked off a new period of trade uncertainty, just as leaders were hoping to move on to other pressing issues. Any renewed turmoil could suck up the geopolitical oxygen at a moment when many in Europe had hoped to focus on other priorities, like securing the fate of Ukraine and protecting themselves against what they say are unfair Chinese trade practices. The court ruled Friday that the president had exceeded his authority when he imposed tariffs on imports from nearly every U.S. trading partner, including 15% tariffs on the European Union. Many trade experts say they believe that the decision will not ultimately upend a trade deal that the 27-nation European Union and Trump struck last year, in large part because the Trump administration has been clear that it has other tools to keep higher tariffs in place. Trump said on social media Saturday that he would impose a 15% across-the-board tariff in the coming months based on legally tested authorities. But the court decision creates major questions. Will the tariffs collected so far be refunded? The Supreme Court did not say. Even more pressingly, how exactly will the Trump administration replace the old tariffs in the longer term? Those unknowns are likely to occupy leaders and officials on both sides of the Atlantic for months. European leaders are closely watching to see how Trump reacts. His back is against the wall. What do you think he's going to do? There is uncertainty, said Neil Duda, the head of economics at Renaissance Macro Research. Europe is definitely going to be affected by that. For now, Europeans have mainly welcomed the Supreme Court's decision without saying much about how exactly they will respond. We remain in close contact with the U.S. administration as we seek clarity on the steps they intend to take in response to this ruling. Olof Gill, a spokesperson for the European Commission, the European Union's executive arm, said after the decision. Brando Benifei, the chair of the European Parliament's delegation for relations with the United States, called the decision a signal of hope and vitality in the system of checks and balances. But the Supreme Court's ruling leaves the EU-US trade deal in limbo. Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, struck an agreement with Trump last year to set tariffs on many European goods at 15%, and that package is still being finalized by the European Parliament. The process has already faced delays. Lawmakers hit pause on the package during recent tensions over Greenland, which Trump has pushed to acquire. Now the question is whether members of the European Parliament will take another break. There are reasons to follow through with the deal, even though the original basis for the 15% tariffs is now invalidated. For one thing, America is clearly willing to find different ways to keep tariffs higher. For another, many European businesses want the certainty that comes with a concrete agreement. No one in Europe should get overly confident, said Joern Fleck, the senior director at the Europe Center at the Atlantic Council, the research organization. The administration's goals haven't changed, and U.S. officials before the ruling said they'll find new ways to recreate these tariffs. Still, several European lawmakers said Friday that they would need to do more analysis in light of the decision. Bernd Lang, the head of the committee in European Parliament that is working on the finalization, posted on the social platform X that he had convened an extraordinary meeting of the negotiating team for Monday to discuss what the Supreme Court decision meant for the agreement. If the decision were to blow up or delay the trade deal, the development would plunge Europe and the United States into a new round of intense economic uncertainty. But even if it didn't, the months ahead are now likely to be politically fraught. Trump and his administration are likely to be distracted as they try to keep tariffs intact. The methods they use would probably leverage existing trade weapons that can be deployed to justify tariffs including national security investigations and inquiries into unfair trading practices. For instance, the U.S. could make the case that Europe's digital regulations, which it has long loathed, amount to a tax on U.S. companies. That could intensify the tension between the United States and Europe. In the very near term, there's going to be a degree of uncertainty, said Jacob Funk Kierkegaard, a senior fellow at the research organization Bruegel, even if it means that in the longer term, the Trump administration will have less total discretion over trade policy, leading to greater stability. For now, without knowing exactly how the Trump administration will move to keep tariffs intact, it could be hard for European businesses to plan. European business wants stability and predictability in the transatlantic relationship, Business Europe, a trade group in Brussels, said in a statement after the court decision. But Fleck said that even if this new source of uncertainty did not make things easier, European leaders have spent the past year figuring out how to work on other priorities, even as trade overshadows other issues. The European Union seems to have learned to adapt and compartmentalize, he said.
U.S. attack on Iran would be complex operation. By Abdi Latif Tahir and Samuel Granados from New York Times. When President Trump said in January that a U.S. armada was heading to Iran, he compared it with the kind of force used in the military's recent lightning operation in Venezuela, saying it was able to rapidly fulfill its mission with speed and violence. Now, as Trump weighs options against the Iranian government, including limited strikes, experts caution that an attack on Iran would be significantly more complex than an operation in Venezuela and could potentially draw the United States into a protracted conflict. Iran's leadership oversees extensive military abilities and a network of regional proxy forces that could help sustain a resistance. And unlike the swift operation in Caracas, Venezuela's capital, Trump is potentially contemplating more extensive military action without saying publicly what he wants to achieve. But he has said that he wants to prevent Iran from building a nuclear weapon and that regime change would be the best thing that could happen. There's no low-cost, easy, clean military option available in the case of Iran, said Ali Vase of the International Crisis Group, an organization focused on resolving conflicts. There's a real risk that there will be American lives lost, Vase said, adding that this will feature highly in Trump's calculus, especially in an election year. Iran can hit back. Whereas Venezuela's skies were relatively unprotected before the U.S. attack in January, Iran has one of the biggest and most varied missile stockpiles in the Middle East, according to regional experts. Its arsenal includes drones and anti-ship weaponry, though the current volume of Iran's missile inventory remains unclear after its 12-day war with Israel in June. Iran's medium-range ballistic missiles were capable of traveling over 1,200 miles, which includes U.S. bases as far away as western Turkey and across the broader Middle East, including in Israel and the Persian Gulf states. On Saturday, Iranian state media reported that Iran had, for the first time, tested a sea-based air defense missile with a range of over 93 miles during military drills this past week in the Strait of Hormuz. Tehran's strategy is to quickly escalate and export instability in multiple theaters so that the cost is spread, the pain is spread, said Sinam Bekele, the director of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House, a policy institute. The Persian Gulf states, which are home to a number of U.S. bases, are anxious that any military strike could lead to blowback against them. In January, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, both of which are close U.S. allies, said they would not permit the United States to use their airspace for attacks. That stance may not ultimately shield them from Iranian retaliation, experts say. As Iranian counterattack could strike cities in Israel, The Israeli military used interceptors to shoot down the majority of Iran's missiles during the war in June. Yet its supply of interceptors is running low after more than 2 years of fending off attacks from Hamas in the Gaza Strip and Hezbollah in Lebanon, intelligence officials say. Fakil said that Iranian officials most likely believe that the fear factor of a larger regional war would help dissuade Trump from attacking. Iran's proxies could threaten U.S. force and allies. Iran operates an axis of resistance that uses proxy forces across the Middle East, including the Houthis in Yemen and Hezbollah in Lebanon. It has built and armed those groups to expand its influence and challenge adversaries in the region. Although many proxies have been severely weakened, they could retaliate against U.S. forces and allies, creating multiple fronts and amplifying the conflict between Iran's borders. At least one Iran-aligned group in Iraq has pledged support for Tehran if the U.S. attacks, with its leaders warning they could order martyrdom operations as part of a broader conflict. Experts also say the Houthis could resume targeting commercial shipping traffic in the Red Sea, as they did in late 2023 in support of Hamas during its war with Israel. The groups backed by Iran know it would be better off hanging together rather than hanging separately, Vaz said. If the mothership sinks, then they are all alone. Iran's leadership is deeply entrenched. The Iranian government is a theocracy in which the supreme leader is the main authority. That is enforced by the Revolutionary Guard, a feared and powerful branch of the armed forces that is estimated to number about 150,000, who safeguard and advance the regime's authoritarian agenda. In Venezuela, the United States captured Nicolas Maduro and his wife in a tightly coordinated raid that lasted just over 2 hours. But in Iran, removing the government is not as simple as ousting the supreme leader. Real power in Iran is driven by ideology, supported by political hardliners, and reinforced by a complex power structure solidified over nearly half a century. Fakil said that a copy-paste operation of Venezuela might be harder to achieve if the goal is decapitation. The economic fallout would be widespread. Iran has previously threatened to close the Strait of Hormuz, choking off one of the world's most important energy shipping lanes. About a fifth of the world's oil and liquefied natural gas navigate the channel. Any disruption in the strait would send energy prices soaring, said Claire Jungman, the director of maritime risk and intelligence at Vortexa, a company that tracks oil and energy trade. Iranian forces have conducted live drills in the strait in recent days, which some experts say is a signal that it could close the waterway if war were to break out. Closing the channel would also harm Iran, restricting its ability to export oil to major customers like China. It will be like bringing down the roof on its head, Bass said.
Pellico publishes memoir about abuse, says she chose happiness as a form of revenge. This is by Catherine Porter of the New York Times. Dateline Paris. Just over a year after her former husband and dozens of other men were convicted of raping her while she was in a drugged state, Giselle Pellico says she is happy and at peace. She's in good health with no flashbacks from the years of abuse. A recent operation cleared her of cervical cancer from one of the four sexually transmitted diseases that the rapists passed to her. In February, she paid off the last of the debts racked up by her former husband, and she's fallen in love with a man who shares her life and hope. Her message to rape victims: you must not give up on being happy. After months of keeping hermetically silent, refusing hundreds of interview requests, and retreating to a small island on France's west coast to heal, Pellico is now speaking out in a spectacular way. Her memoir, A Hymn to Life, was released this past week in 22 languages with an English audiobook read by actress Emma Thompson. And she started a 2-month book tour to give talks and interviews about how she survived her ordeal and chose happiness as her revenge. On Friday, she was in London for an event with actors Kristen Scott Thomas and Kate Winslet, who were recruited to read excerpts from the book to an audience of thousands. At the tour's end in April, Pellicot, a former logistics executive, will stand alongside President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine to receive a major award recognizing her bravery in speaking out. For the first time in years, she's looking to the horizon and not through the rearview mirror. She wants to heal her relationships with her 3 children, 2 of whom broke contact after the traumatizing trial. On Thursday, she had lunch with her eldest grandson, Nathan, whom she said she had not spoken with since the trial. And she now hopes for a shared future with Jean Loup, her new partner and a retired steward for Air France. While she once felt uncomfortable with her status as a feminist icon, she's now accepted the mantle to honor the thousands of women who wrote her heartfelt letters, lined up outside the courthouse to cheer her, and still stop her regularly in the street to thank her. "Those women truly gave me such incredible strength," she said. Pellicot has survived a horror that's hard to imagine. Her beloved partner of 50 years mixed sleeping and anti-anxiety medication in her food and drink for almost a decade. Then, when she was in a near comatose state, he would rape her, and he invited dozens of men he met online to rape her too. He documented it all in thousands of videos and photographs that he stored in a digital folder called Abuse. Dominique Pellicot's crimes were discovered only because he was caught in a grocery store taking pictures of women's skirts and arrested. After investigating his computer and phones, police called Giselle Pellicot and asked her to come to the station. The next time she saw her husband in person was at the trial almost 4 years later. During the trial, Pellicot revealed little of herself. "I joined the hordes of journalists in line each day outside the courtroom and watched in awe as she remained calm and poised and delivered sharp testimony in measured tones. Her comments were laced with acute feminist analysis, though she said she had never taken interest in feminist causes. Her calm and composure made her an enigma to the investigating judge and police officers, her therapists, and even her own children. Now, in the book she worked on with French journalist and writer Judith Perignon over 10 months, she has taken off the emotional body armor. She explains that she learned to don when she was 9 after her mother got ill and died. After Dominique Pellicot's arrest, her children arrived to disassemble her home like a crime scene. Her daughter, Caroline, ripped up all of the family pictures. Giselle Pellicot's life was reduced to 2 bags and her bulldog, Lancôme. After months staying with her children, she moved to Île de Ré, where she went for long walks with Lancôme, ransacking her memory for signs she missed, wondering how I might have prevented it all. I might have saved us, she wrote. She consumed the classic victim's cocktail of shame and guilt. In the end, she said she found no explanation for what had happened, except what she learned from psychiatrists who said during the trial that her former husband had a split psyche. To their children, the heinous revelations found in Dominique Pellicot's abuse folder were proof that their happy childhood memories were unbearable lies. But Giselle Pellicot refuses to let his crimes poison the memories of her former husband's face. It was her survival strategy. I needed to believe that the 50 years spent with Mr. Pellicot hadn't been just one big lie, in order to keep on living, she explained. Otherwise, I'd be dead. I would no longer exist. Those mental guardrails extend toward the questions that haunt her children. Caroline, their daughter, remains tormented by the thought that her father drugged and raped her, too. Police investigators recovered 2 intimate photographs of her asleep in bed among his erased digital files. During the trial, Dominique Pellicot initially denied taking the images, but he later said he had been forced to by a blackmailer. He repeatedly denied sexually abusing his children or grandchildren. Pellicot was convicted on charges of having taken the intimate photographs without Caroline's permission, not rape, because there was not enough evidence, the prosecutor explained. Giselle Pellicot took hope from that. Without evidence, without a confession, I could not bring myself to say that the irreparable had taken place, she wrote, above all for her sake. Her daughter saw it as both an abandonment and denial. The two stopped talking after the trial, although they recently rekindled their communication, Pellicot said. She has not spoken to her son David in more than a year. David declined an interview and Caroline did not respond to requests for comment. Pellicot said she hoped the book would help heal her family by revealing parts of her life her children and grandchildren never heard and help them understand why she reacted to the horror the way she had. Her lunch with her grandson this past week was hopefully the beginning of a long journey of reconciliation, she said. Don't believe that tragedy brings a family together, Pellicot said. It's a blast that swept everything away. And today, everyone is trying to rebuild themselves as best they can, above all. Not as they want to, but as they can.
The Bones of St. Francis, A Mixed Blessing, by Nicole Winfield from Associated Press. Dateline, SEC, Italy. The Bones of St. Francis of Assisi, the medieval friar who inspired Pope Francis and generations of Christians before him, are going on public display for the first time, giving his hilltop Umbrian hometown yet another reason to welcome pilgrims. That's a mixed blessing for Assisi Mayor Walter Stoppini, residents, and the Franciscan friars who are organizing the month-long display of relics to commemorate the 800th anniversary of the saint's death this year. Already, nearly 400,000 people have registered to pray before the relics, and Stoppini estimates the number could well reach a 500,000 before the bones go back into their tomb March 22nd. A small army of 400 volunteers have been recruited to herd them through the medieval city's cobblestone streets and into the lower Basilica of St. Francis to view the bones, which are held in a bulletproof glass blocks. That will put enormous strain on the city center, with its narrow souvenir-lined streets and limited services. But it will also test the patience of Assisi's residents, who are no stranger to mass influxes of pilgrims, but usually just for limited celebrations. We're used to this kind of event, but that lasts for 1, 2, or 3 days, Stoppini said. That is something prolonged. For a month, so I'm a bit worried, but calm. Assisi is one of the world's most popular Christian pilgrimage destinations, located on a hill of the Umbrian countryside and built with a pink-tinged limestone that gives it its unique glow, especially at sunset. Millions of pilgrims flock here each year, thanks to the presence of St. Francis' tombs and the spectacular basilica, decorated with Giotto's frescoes illustrating the saint's life that rises over it. St. Francis was born into a wealthy family in 1182, but renounced his wealth to live as a mendicant friar after receiving what he said was a vocation to rebuild and reform the church. He is best known for his message of peace, his love of creation, and attending to the poor, teachings that strongly inspired Pope Francis, the first pope to name himself after the saint. While St. Francis's remains have been periodically inspected over the years by the Franciscan friars to ensure their conservation, this is the first time they are going on display publicly. The decision to remove them from the crypt and welcome pilgrims for a month is a means to keeping his message alive and give Christians a chance to pray before them, officials said. Stoppini said a month-long exhibition was the maximum he could ask of Assisi's residents given the strain on the city that already saw a massive influx of pilgrims in 2025. For the souvenir merchants of Assisi, who make their living off religious tourists and pilgrims who flock to the picturesque town, a month-long event is welcome. Other people will see what we see every day with Francis's spirit imbuing the town, said shopkeeper Arianna Caterinelli, who works in a souvenir shop on the main drag of town leading to the Basilica. The shop features Assisi emblazoned sweatshirts, pens, St. Francis-themed coffee mugs, and neon rosaries. Assisi's resident, Riccardo Bacconi, who works in a local bank branch, acknowledged the town lives from tourism, and anyone who chooses to live here has to put up with it. I don't judge it negatively. Economically, it's important, he said. There are more advantages than disadvantages.
A new problem hits NASA moon rocket, bumping trip again. This is by Marcia Dunn of the Associated Press. Dateline Cape Canaveral, Florida. NASA's new moon rocket suffered another setback Saturday, almost certain to bump astronauts' first lunar trip in decades into spring. The space agency revealed the latest problem just one day after targeting March 6 for the Artemis II mission, humanity's first flight to the moon in more than half a century. Overnight, the flow of helium to the rocket's upper stage was interrupted, officials said. Solid helium flow is essential for purging the engines and pressurizing the fuel tanks. This helium issue has nothing to do with the hydrogen fuel leaks that marred a countdown dress rehearsal of the Space Launch System rocket earlier this month and forced a repeat test. NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman said a bad filter, valve, or connection plate could be to blame for the stalled helium flow. Regardless of the problem, he noted, the only way to access the area and fix the problem is in the vehicle assembly building at Kennedy Space Center. We'll begin preparations for rollback, and this will take the March launch window out of consideration, Isaacman said via X. NASA's next opportunities would be at the beginning or end of April. Earlier in the morning, NASA said it was preparing to return the 322-foot rocket to its hangar for repairs while raising the possibility of the work being done at the pad. I understand people are disappointed by this development, Isaacman said. That disappointment is felt most by the team at NASA, who've been working tirelessly to prepare for this great endeavor. Hydrogen fuel leaks had already delayed the Artemis II lunar fly-around by a month. A second fueling test on Thursday revealed hardly any leaks, giving managers the confidence to aim for a March liftoff. The four astronauts went into their two-week quarantine Friday night, mandatory for avoiding germs. The interrupted helium flow was confined to the SLS rocket's interim cryogenic propulsion stage. This upper stage is essential for placing the Orion crew capsule into the proper high-altitude orbit around Earth for checkout following liftoff. After that, it's supposed to separate from Orion and serve as a target for the astronauts inside the capsule, allowing them to practice docking techniques for future moon missions. During NASA's Apollo program, 24 astronauts flew to the moon from 1968 through 1972. The new Artemis program has completed only one flight so far, a lunar orbiting mission without a crew in 2022.
Fans rooting for Lonely Monkey stuffed toy. By Maggie Penman and Kyle Melnick from Washington Post. What's it like to have millions of fans but struggle to make friends? For Punch, a 7-month-old macaque, fame and loneliness have collided, leaving the world watching as he clings to a stuffed orangutan toy from IKEA. Punch was abandoned shortly after birth and raised by the staff at the Ichikawa City Zoo outside Tokyo. Baby monkeys often clutch their mothers for comfort and security, so the staff gave Punch a surrogate. He carries the toy around with him and runs back to it for comfort when scolded or rejected by other monkeys, according to a statement on X from the zoo. The zoo and botanical garden has been posting regularly about Punch's progress as he tries to integrate with the other macaques after moving in with them last month at the zoo's Monkey Mountain. The baby monkey now has masses of dedicated human fans around the world cheering him on, though he's still learning how to socialize with his own species. Videos have gone viral showing Punch looking lonesome and snuggling with his soft toy, or approaching other monkeys in the enclosure with varying degrees of success. Some videos show Punch being outright rejected by the group of primates, or even seemingly bullied. In a statement posted Friday on X, the zoo confirmed that videos of Punch being dragged by other monkeys seemed to be authentic, and explained that this part of his journey as he learns how to be a monkey without his mother to show him the ropes. Punch has been scolded by other monkeys many times in the past and has learned how to socialize with them, the statement said. The zoo staff also noted that after moments of conflict with other monkeys, Punch runs back to his comfort object, his stuffed toy orangutan. When he feels safe again, he will leave his toy and return to his peers. Punch has also been seen clinging to zookeepers' legs when they enter the enclosure. The small zoo has been overwhelmed by visitors and long lines since its posts about Punch started dominating social media feeds. Larger crowds still are expected this weekend and Monday, which is a holiday in Japan. Punch has also become an accidental influencer of sorts. IKEA told the Washington Post that there has been a marked increase in sales of the Jungle Sog orangutan toy, and asked for patience from customers who visit stores in Japan, the United States, and Korea, where the toy has sold out. "We're making sure that the toy is back in the stock as soon as possible," Javier Quinones, a commercial manager for IKEA's Inca Group, said in a statement. "The toy has long been one of our most sought after across markets, and the story from Japan is now giving it a little extra love." For biologists and psychologists watching from afar, this has been a reminder of a famous experiment that changed the thinking about caregiving in primates, including humans. "The first thing I thought was, we've done this experiment," said Joanne Silk, a professor of evolution at Arizona State University. In the 1950s and 60s, American psychologist Harry Harlow conducted experiments with rhesus monkeys that demonstrated that comfort and affection are almost as essential as food for infants. He separated infant monkeys from their mothers, "we wouldn't do that now," Silk said, "and gave them everything they needed to survive except their mothers. The baby monkeys struggled socially, often failing to mate. If they did not have offspring, they didn't know how to care for them. In one experiment, infants could get food from a wire mother, but also were given a soft cloth surrogate mother for comfort. The infant monkey spends all of their time with the cloth mothers, going to the wire mother only to feed. When distressed or scared, the cloth mother provided comfort and security, demonstrating that caregivers weren't only important for basic needs, but also emotional ones." "That really shook people up," Silk said. Developmental psychologists had previously discouraged parents from spoiling children with too much affection, but Harlow's experiments changed ideas about how human infants should be raised, especially orphans in institutions. Silk explained that without his mother to help him navigate the social world, Punch has an uphill climb. She thinks that he has a good shot at overcoming his lonely early life, but it depends on the social group allowing him in. Someone being willing to groom him, let him sit close to them, let him sleep near them. Silk has noticed people on social media saying they want to adopt Punch. "I know the sort of human impulse is to intervene," Silk said, "but she advises that's not the solution. He's got to live a monkey life," she said.
Next up, from the ideas section, frictionless fascism. Technologies being used for immigration enforcement take human agency and discernment out of the equation. This is by Flynn Coleman. "One weekend in January, two boys stood quivering at Mercado Central, a Minneapolis market. Their mother had dropped them off for haircuts and walked across the street to cash a check. but she didn't return. Immigration and Customs Enforcement took her. The boys tried to find her in the detention database, but couldn't because they didn't know her birthday. The agents who took her didn't need it. This is how ICE now operates. Mobile Fortify, a facial recognition app it deploys, can verify her identity nearly instantly. The technology makes detention possible with nothing more than what a camera captures. The system already had what it wanted, and she was gone. In my time documenting war crimes and crimes against humanity at the international tribunals for Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia, I learned that dehumanization requires infrastructure. In Rwanda, it took months of radio broadcasts to incite neighbors to kill neighbors. At roadblocks across the country, Hutu militias checked identity cards, Tutsi or Hutu, and made decisions about who would live or die. This took weeks. Even then, some refused to take part. Some hid Tutsis in their homes, risking their own lives. Human beings, even trained for atrocity, sometimes hesitated. Violence and dehumanization have always been limited by human friction. The pause before pulling a trigger. The moment when someone looks into another person's eyes and cannot do the worst thing. Mobile Fortify needs only seconds to scan a face. That's the innovation. This is what fascism without friction looks like. Hitler needed years of rallies, screaming himself hoarse to convince crowds. A steady drumbeat of dehumanization. Mussolini needed propaganda campaigns. Even then, enforcement depended on human beings making decisions at every checkpoint. Mobile Fortify needs mere moments. Point your phone, the algorithm decides. The agent executes. No hesitation, no pause. Mobile Fortify is a smartphone app that compares faces with more than 200 million photos without individualized warrants, without meaningful consent, and according to the Department of Homeland Security documents, without any practical mechanism for refusal. Representative Bernie Thompson says ICE treats a biometric match as definitive. Agents can ignore birth certificates if the app says otherwise. When the machine's word contradicts yours, the machine wins. The boys at Mercado Central could not find their mother. The government has billions of dollars in surveillance infrastructure. That power asymmetry isn't accidental. It's the architecture. Technology determines who can challenge decisions, who can trace targeting, who can find their parents. The algorithm designed the cage, the children cannot see the bars. On January 14th in Robbinsdale, Minnesota, another parent stood at a bus stop with their child waiting for the school bus. ICE detained the parent in front of the child, in front of a bus full of elementary students. The child went to school that day not knowing if their parent would come home. The children on that bus learned what power looks like now, automated, inescapable. America didn't invent this template for making dehumanization systematic. China pioneered algorithmic targeting of Uyghurs in 2017. Iran deployed facial recognition for hijab enforcement. Russia built digital surveillance states, but when the United States adopts these tactics at home, it legitimizes them globally. Mobile Fortify doesn't break new ground, it normalizes the playbook. What was once the domain of acknowledged autocrats becomes standard democratic practice. The masked agents who surged into Minnesota have begun their retreat. The algorithmic infrastructure remains. Mobile Fortify still scans faces in seconds. Surveillance drones still circle neighborhoods. Administrative subpoenas requiring no judge, no warrant, still demand digital records. Google accounts, Discord metadata, social security numbers, often within hours. The facial recognition databases still hold 200 million images. The tech industry is spending hundreds of millions to ensure no regulation follows, building a political war chest to keep violence frictionless. The agents may withdraw, the algorithms never do. Hundreds of children remain in detention facilities across the country. 13-year-old Gustavo Santiago, detained in Dilley, Texas, wrote, "I feel like I'll never get out of here. I just ask you to not forget about us." Frictionless fascism removes the last human barrier to atrocity, the pause, the moment one's conscience might emerge from the depths. Even soldiers trained for systematic violence sometimes refuse orders. Even forces prepared for ethnic cleansing sometimes let people through. The algorithm never refuses, never hesitates, never witnesses. It doesn't need years of propaganda or to convince anyone to hate. It doesn't need belief, consent, or even your attention. It just needs a face to scan.
What Economics is For? By Richard Hanania. When I was in academia, I noticed that often in political science, economics, and philosophy courses, one of the first things students would be taught was the difference between positive and normative statements. Positive statements are factual assertions made about the real world, such as what causes poverty. Normative statements deal in the realm of values, what is desirable, and what we want to happen. For example, we can debate whether there is anything morally objectionable about an economy generating high levels of inequality. I used to think that this distinction was so obvious that it was a waste of time to go over these concepts in college classrooms. When I started writing for a broader audience, at some point I realized that people have a great deal of difficulty separating an inquiry into what is true from their beliefs about the way they want the world to be. Few things demonstrate this more clearly than ongoing debates about the role of economics in politics and intellectual discourse. Recently, comedian Jon Stewart had the Nobel Prize-winning economist Richard Thaler on his show. Stewart repeatedly admitted that his knowledge of the discipline was quite limited, but he confidently declared that the goal of economics in a capitalist system is to make the most amount of money for your shareholders. As Stewart described it, the field has no concern with improving the human condition, but focuses on just making money for the companies that are extracting the fossil fuels from the earth. Some journalists and many economists from across the political spectrum objected to his characterization of the discipline. Then Stewart appeared to double down by welcoming Orrin Kass on his show. Kass is a right-leaning economist who has criticized the field, albeit for different reasons. While Stewart believes that economics is deployed to, say, stop policies that can deal with climate change, Kass laments that economics have not adequately considered how mass migration and free trade have brought down wages and weakened social cohesion. The mistake both of them are making can be detected in Stewart's use of the phrase, the goal of economics. No one would say goal of physics is to build nuclear weapons or that the goal of chemistry is to create new medicines. Those are possible uses of knowledge derived from these fields. But the goal of the disciplines themselves is the production of knowledge. One can oppose the building of nuclear weapons, but in that case one problem is not with physics, but with the policymakers who use physics for undesirable ends. Or, at most, with a subset of physics that has certain applications. Of course, like all scholars, economists sometimes have strong political views. And they may use their expertise to sneak in normative considerations that are based not on empirical evidence, but on their own value system. Yet it is simply false to say that economists don't think about questions like how to address climate change or problems that communities may have. For example, the economists Anne Case and Angus Deaton have done more than any other scholars to draw attention to the rise of deaths of despair in the United States over the last decade and a half. Questions like the impacts of climate change and what can be done to stop it and how diversity impacts societal outcomes have rich literatures that skeptics of the field like Stewart are practically never familiar with. And that is all the time that we have for today. Thank you for listening in and enjoy the rest of your weekend.